It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Open to Debate. I'm John Donvan. We are before a live audience at Freedom Fest in Memphis, where this time we're debating the question, is legalizing marijuana a mistake? Let's get right to it. We're going to be starting with our first round. First round, each debater has an opening statement. And speaking first, he's a senior legal research fellow in the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, Paul Larkin, Jr. Paul, the floor is yours. Your answer to the question is yes. Legalizing marijuana is a mistake. Please tell us why.
Thank you very much. Gaul may have been divided into three parts, but cannabis takes only two: medical use and recreational use. Each one has to be separately considered, although it is true that each one bleeds over into the other a little. But let's start with medical use cannabis. The bottom line is this: the cannabis plant has numerous cannabinoids that are valuable and that we need further research into to see how, when, where, and why they can be used. But smoking a doobie is not medicine. That's not my opinion. That's the opinion of the late Professor Mark Kleiman, a friend who was an expert in the field of cannabis and supported recreational use legalization. He said, the cannabinoids have useful medical value, but not smoking the raw agricultural form. It's also the view of Dr. Peter Bach, an oncologist in New York, who has said, yes, cannabis makes you feel better, but so does Budweiser, and nobody thinks Budweiser is a medicine. The third reason is, for 80 years, the United States has trusted the Food and Drug Administration to decide what is a drug and whether that drug is safe and effective. And the FDA has never made that call because there is no guarantee that there are not adulterants. So let's put the medical use aside, in part because the medical use was really just an entree to get into the recreational use. So let me talk about that. The problem with recreational use is that smoking cannabis, rather than taking the pill form approved by the FDA, is going to harm the users as well as third parties. It can harm users if they're minors, because minors have a very labile brain, and that brain is still developing, and we don't know that it's not going to be adversely affected by cannabis. It can harm pregnant women, nursing women, and the children that they bear or bore, because we don't know yet what the effect is going to be. But the gravest and most obvious harm is from drug-impaired driving. You legalize it, you're going to have an increase in the number of people. They're going to get behind the wheel of a car. There are going to be crashes that lead to fatalities or other adverse consequences. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul Larkin. And now we're going to hear from the president and CEO of the Marijuana Policy Project and a former member of the Illinois Senate, Toy Hutchinson. Toy, the floor is yours. Your answer to the question, is legalizing marijuana a mistake, is a no. Please tell us why.
Thank you so much for being here, and thank you for that opening statement. I really think that most of the points that were just raised prove why we need to actually legalize. We won't get to the answers of exactly what that research will show until we have robust research, which cannot happen in an environment where it's still federally illegal. Right now, the National Institute of Health actually does 90% of their research on researching the harms, very little of it on researching the benefits. And that's in the face of thousands of years of use across this globe that's in the face of understanding that every single human being has an endocannabinoid system that keeps the body in stasis. It's in the face of multiple medical associations across various different studies and disciplines, including the Epilepsy Foundation, the National Institute for Health and or HIV and AIDS Medicine, the National American Nurses Association. There's a number of pediatric organizations that talk about pediatric things like seizures and the very real benefits that come from using cannabinoids to treat almost untreatable symptoms before this. And we all know what happens for people who are actually terminally ill and dying. So whether or not cannabis cures cancer or hardcore issues like that that we are plagued with, it's definitely been chosen, or definitely been shown to have multiple benefit effects. And that's on top of 38 states right now who have a regulatory system in the medical arena, which means they're helping hundreds of thousands of people that can no longer be ignored. On the adult use side, if we understand the impacts of the criminal justice system and we understand exactly the entry point into the criminal justice system right now, above almost any other things, it's connection to law enforcement through cannabis use. And the fact is, we are living in this insane conflict of law where it's not going away. Marijuana is not leaving anytime soon. It's been here for thousands of years, and it's only really been criminalized for the last 90. And we are learning more and more every single day about the benefits, about trying to reduce harm, and about creating a health-safe society for everyone, which is nowhere near what it is we have today. If anyone believes that the current system we have today is beneficial, or that for some reason, for the first time in the history of the world, that a ban or a prohibition is going to help or stop, these are the reasons why we need to move towards a legalization framework so that we can actually get to some of the answers that most of us are concerned about. It's more important now than it ever has been.
Thank you, Toy. Our next speaker will be answering again, as Paul did, yes, in answer to the question that legalizing marijuana is a mistake. She is a senior policy advisor at the Foundation for Drug Policy Solutions, Teresa Haley. Teresa, the floor is yours. Please tell us why your answer to that question is yes.
Yes, it is harmful. In the state of Illinois, when they legalized it just a few years ago, they said it was going to help the community, especially Black and brown people. As we know, throughout America, more people who look like me were incarcerated because of using marijuana and other substance. In Illinois, it has not helped. We still have a problem with unemployment. We still have a problem with mental health issues. I have family members who've used marijuana since it became legal in Illinois. It's caused other issues, schizophrenia, depression, and people wonder why they can't get jobs. I just retired from the state of Illinois. We have a drug-free, alcohol-free policy. It means that if you drive a CDL or you have any other type of specialized license, you cannot use marijuana. If you test positive, you automatically lose your job. In the city in which I live, Springfield, Illinois, they decided the tax revenue that was going to come from marijuana was going to go to those communities who were most impacted in a negative way. That has not happened. Only 3% of the tax money from marijuana sales goes back to the Black community or the poor, disadvantaged communities. And out of that 3%, 1.5% we have to share with the fire and police protection. That's what our city councils decided. Let's see what the legislators are going to decide in your city. Let's look at San Francisco. Let's look at Denver, Colorado. Let's look at some of the other major cities who have legalized marijuana and the impact that it's had. Drugs kill people. But marijuana continues to be a gateway drug. Those who are using marijuana, guess what? They're going to start using something else. In my community, I've had family members who've come home from prison, and now they're smoking weed. But they can't afford to go to the dispensary and get the weed because it's still very expensive. Do you all realize that if you use a vape pen, which is oil, smoking marijuana, it equals 7 joints? Can you imagine just sitting in one setting, knowing anyone who smokes puff, puff, blow, 7 joints in a row? It's not reality. It doesn't happen. So what we have to do is to educate the community about the harm and the impact of using marijuana. It is killing our communities. Again, it is a gateway drug. Thank you.
And rounding out our debater panel, the Director of Drug Markets and Legal Regulation at the Drug Policy Alliance, Kat Packer.
Good afternoon, folks. We've just started this debate, and I am already tired. I'm tired of the lies that are being spread on this stage already. It's ridiculous. I'm the youngest person on this stage. I'm 32 years old, and I have to tell you that I started in this space as a reformer for some of the same reasons that were listed here. I recognize that there are challenges associated with our cannabis policies today. I recognize that marijuana is not harmless. It's not for everyone. It's not for children. Legalization is not meant to be a free-for-all, and it's not. If you look across the United States today, what we have is not exactly legalization. It's a combination of prohibition, decriminalization, some legalization, and more importantly, regulation. We have to move beyond this conversation about yes or no on cannabis. Americans have already said yes. Your communities have already said yes. And even in places that haven't legalized already, they're saying yes. Legalization does not, and criminalization does not prevent folks from having access to cannabis. The question that we have to ask ourselves is, are we going to continue to be prohibitionists and stick our heads in the sand and say, we don't have any solutions, we don't have any levers, we don't have any policy options? Or are we going to be proactive and confront the complexities, the challenges, the actual human costs of what we're talking about? That's the option that we have with legalization. We don't have any of those options with prohibition. Just say no, it didn't work. But if we choose to legalize and regulate the right way, and let me be clear, I think that there is a right and a wrong way to do this. But if we do this the right way, then we can, for the first time, confront these issues, try and put forth policies that are fair, that are equitable, that respect an individual's autonomy as an adult, primarily adults 21 and older, to make a decision. We talked about folks in the cannabis closet. That's unhealthy. We shouldn't be stigmatizing folks for consuming cannabis. I'm a cannabis consumer. We can have this moral debate, but I'm a cannabis consumer. I'm a three-time graduate. I graduated from law school. I've worked in government. Cannabis has not prevented me from being successful. But what I can tell you is that if I were criminalized, if I were arrested, would that make you safer? Would that make our community safer? No. The mistake has always been prohibition. Legalization is our opportunity to get it right.
This is Open to Debate. More when we return.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Open to Debate. I'm your host, John Donvan. Let's return to our discussion. Now we'll move into a portion of discussion where we talk about these ideas, but I just want to say what I've heard from the two sides. The side that is arguing, yes, that legalization is a mistake, is leading with essentially a health argument, an impact on society in terms of issues like people driving under the influence, the impact on young minds, that it's dangerous, that it can essentially corrode the fabric of a community and have long-term negative consequences if there's not some sort of ban or prohibition. On the other side, we're hearing the argument made that you're banning and prohibit something that people are going to be doing anyway, and that while this side does not disagree that not everybody should be using, that there needs to be more clarity in the laws, more creativity in the kinds of solutions that actually work, that blanket criminalization just does no good in the long run. So what I want to start with, though, is just to clarify a piece of the argument that I didn't hear any of you make, which is where you come down on the question of whether possession and use by an individual is essentially a private matter in the same way that a decision to eat poorly could be a private matter, or is it a social issue, or is it a combination of the two? Paul, if you could take 30 seconds, 40 seconds to answer that, I'd like to know where you are on that.
Sure. The federal government regulates food. The Department of Agriculture regulates food. So what we're trying to do is protect the safety of the public. And if you have a substance, whether it's a food or a drug, that is potentially going to cause risk, we have always put the burden of proof on the people promoting that substance.
Let me take it to the other side. Toy?
I think it's interesting. Right now, the CDC attributes 140,000 deaths every single year to alcohol and its effects alone. Just that alone. It attributes zero deaths to cannabis. So while we will always be in a space where we have to deal with what are the things that we can make decisions about on our own when we're harming nobody else, and then how does that impact the public good? It's, in my mind, the very best example that we can have to
use
for that.
See, I disagree with that, Toy, for the simple reason in my county, in Sangamon County, we just had two young people who were killed from other people driving under the influence. And it wasn't alcohol. It was marijuana. But what we do is we give people a ticket and we give them a pass. So marijuana and driving under the influence does kill.
At this point, even a ticket for driving under the influence of alcohol is largely a ticket. There are still criminal penalties that end up happening. And vehicular manslaughter is a horrible and horrendous thing. The issue that I'm saying is that, yes, we have a public reason for dealing with what are the public impacts of this, which only happen in a regulatory framework. It only happens when you get to a legalization standpoint. I do want to clear up some records, because in your opening statement, you said 3%. You're talking about Sangamon County taxes. Across the state of Illinois, one out of every $4 that's sold in a legally regulated place goes to a community reinvestment program. That's 25%, not 3%. And
but
they go
to
specific.
It's up to the local legislators to decide on how they want to use that money.
Guess how much money folks collect and goes back into the communities when cannabis is unregulated?
Absolutely zero.
Okay. Thank you.
But it's not helping our community either way.
According to the
according
to receive these funds,
the haves and the
have-nots,
it is not helping the have-nots.
So one of the questions that I have for prohibitionists often is, like, what is your actual policy solution?
We don't consider ourselves to be prohibitionists. We consider ourselves to be educated, and I think this is an educated discussion. And we need to educate our communities on the pros and the cons.
Is education preventing folks from having access to cannabis?
Education is informing them that when they go and purchase it, what the size effects may be, the possible side effects. And
when,
that's
when
really
they purchase
what
it from
about.
Where? When they purchase it from
a dispensary.
I mean, and this is what we have to talk about when we're talking about legalization. People can either purchase it on the street when they have no idea what the potency is, when they have no idea what extra stuff is mixed in their product, or you can have products that are tested,
you can have
that are labeled,
go buy
that you know that it
from
comes
a liquor
from,
store, they go
which
to
is
the
also illegal.
I'm going to call a timeout. I'm going to call a timeout because I haven't heard from Paul in a little bit. So
you can smoke an entire field of cannabis and it's not going to stop your breathing. And that's what they're referring to when they say no one's died from using cannabis, because there aren't enough mu receptors in the brainstem for it to turn off the automatic respiratory system. But my colleague is right when she says cannabis can kill, because people who have gotten behind the wheel of a car who shouldn't and have killed other people. What I haven't heard anybody talk about yet is the tremendous increase in potency we've seen in cannabis since the 1960s.
But I think your opponents are acknowledging that potency is there and saying you need to be talking dosages, you need research, you need standardization, and legalization allows that.
And research is what I'm in favor of.
But Paul, the brother from the neighborhood, he doesn't care about the dosage. He just wants to know if he can get his weed or not.
A stereotype.
That's not true.
That's an absolute stereotype.
That's a fact.
As a cannabis consumer, and I've been consuming cannabis for several years now, I can tell you that when I walk into a store, because I agree, I think that some of the cannabis on the market, the potency is too high. I'm actually going into stores and looking for lower THC cannabis products. Like, I'd prefer to have a cannabis product where the THC percentage was anywhere between 11 and 17%. Now, there are a range of different potencies, but I wouldn't even have the option if we didn't have a regulated market. And so, Paul, if your concern is potency, the way that we get to addressing potency concerns is through legalization and regulation. You could actually have states put caps on potency. There are even states that are talking about having potency-based taxes. There are all of these different tools that government has for the first time when you bring things out of the shadows and into the light. And that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, but you see, the problem is this. You can't treat cannabis like it's an ordinary consumer good, like it's a stereo, okay, or a baseball glove. The 10%
no, we treat it like it's like alcohol, which like literally kills people by the hundreds
yes.
of thousands
yes.
and is legal in all 50 states.
And, then you
and nobody's talking about recriminalizing
well.
Any of those things. And the reduction in smoking, the reduction in alcohol use, and the times for, say, these are not the days where it's like the Mad Men time where you were pregnant and somebody would hand you a cigarette and your little mommy's helper and you could have a martini when you were stressed, because we know more now. It did not, alcohol's still legal, tobacco's still legal. But the education and the research that goes with reducing harm and reducing use only happens under that scenario. You cannot control what is in the shadows.
But what we're talking about is legalizing another dangerous drug. Because it's not
what
that we're going to adopt.
Regulating
we're not going to adopt
regulating
as a substitute for alcohol. It's in addition to
alcohol. So how many people go to the dispensary or go to the street pharmacist and say, what potency is this weed that you're selling me? There are several
millions,
different flavors
millions
and several
of people,
different types
millions
of weed.
Millions of people. The cannabis consumer is actually a quite educated one, as opposed to the stereotypes that allow us to believe that, you know, nothing good is ever going to happen to you. When you tell a whole large segment of society that this is not going to do anything good, they see the opposite. When we need to tell them about the things that will kill them, when we need to protect our children from things that cause harm, how often will they believe us then? Which is also what it is we're saying.
And also, we made sure that children under 21, it wasn't attracted to them because it didn't look like candy.
You'd be hard-pressed to get any room anywhere to have a whole bunch of people who say that they didn't try alcohol before they were the age of 21.
You may get a lot of people, but you will get some that will tell you they did not.
Yes, and you will get some who will tell you they've never had cannabis, they never intend to have cannabis.
I never have because
I
felt like, you know what?
Perfectly fine.
Time out again. I want to take to the side arguing against legalization. The argument that has not really been addressed yet, that Kat brought up, that a regime that criminalizes use of and possession of marijuana has disproportionately hurt black and brown people, that's just the pattern. I want to ask you to take that on first, Teresa, because for the very same reason you're arguing the opposite side of it. But can you address their concern? A world where use is criminalized has a disproportionate impact in just the way things play out in terms of incarceration, arrests, lives ruined for a crime that may not hurt anybody but the individual, is disproportionately hurting minorities as opposed to whites.
It is disproportionately hurting minorities. I work with a bunch of children, and our kids come to school, and they're shameful. They're embarrassed because they smell like weed, because their parents use weed, and now that it's illegal, it's okay for them to use it. But they don't think about the impact that it has on their children, and they're embarrassed. They say they can't sleep, they can't function, they can't study. But then they grow up and say, it's okay for me to use it because my parents used it.
But I think your opponents are saying for those parents to go to jail would be
no.
a lot worse.
No, those parents need to go to treatment.
Uh-huh.
Those parents need to understand the impact that it's having not only on their lives and their health, but their children.
I think that part of the issue here is that we treat all cannabis use as if it's problematic. And in reality, the vast majority of cannabis consumers are able to do so responsibly. I'm not a parent, Toya, so I'll pass things to her to share about her experience as a mother.
Yeah, when we first started taking this on, there were a lot of people who talked to us about, it's always, what about the children? We need to help the children, save the children. Well, if you want to keep this out of schools, first you have to acknowledge that it's in schools. If you want to keep it out of parks, first you have to acknowledge that it's in the parks. There's nobody going to stand between my kid and the drug trade around the neighborhood unless we got in the middle of this. So I had to learn to talk to them the exact same way we talk about alcohol. I did about whether or not it was appropriate for them under the age of 21, not as adults, about how you behave when you go out into society, and about the stigma and the stereotypes that will inure to them much stronger than it will to other things. African-American people use this at the same rates of every other demographic in this country, but it would have been parental malfeasance for me not to warn my children about what an encounter with law enforcement would be, especially with my sons. The fact that we have this now, we're talking about 42 states, over 50% of the population now lives in some legal jurisdiction. If this is the one thing we cannot talk about, then I cannot keep my children safe. And for me, looking at the policy about it, I don't believe that every person who walks onto a gambling casino is a gambling addict. I don't believe every person who smokes cannabis is going to have a problem with it. So we've got to have a system around by which, if public health and safety is the thing that we need to care about, especially for children, then reducing stigma, stereotypes, and all that comes with not actually reaching families is lost if you don't have a legalization or regulatory scheme.
Okay.
It's just gone.
I want to talk a little bit about what experience has shown so far. We know that 20, 21 years ago, Portugal decriminalized all narcotics. I want to make clear it's all narcotics. But in the last 4 or 5 years, they've begun to regret that, and they're beginning to make efforts to roll it back because they're seeing an increase in addiction. They're seeing an increase in overdoses. The longest running experiment we have here is Colorado, Paul. What have we learned from Colorado in terms of whether it has worked? And let's talk about what the goals were. The goals were, again, for people who were using not to have their lives ruined because of an arrest. The goals were to replace an illicit market with a legal market that would be controlled, and an illicit market brings with it all other kinds of crime and violence. And the goals were essentially to bring it out into the open, so to make it alcohol, essentially the parallel to alcohol. How has it all worked out as far as you can tell us in Colorado?
Well, Colorado is a state that has its own criminal code. I know as a person who focuses on the federal government, the idea that there are a large number of people in federal prison for cannabis crimes is just not remotely true. President Biden pardoned everybody in federal prison last fall who had been convicted of simple cannabis possession, and the Bureau of Prisons admitted they didn't have to release anyone because there wasn't anybody in prison for simple cannabis possession. So let's talk about that. You can plea bargain a more serious offense down to a lighter one. So it may well be that the number of people who are in Colorado's prisons because of simple possession offenses wound up in there because of a plea bargain that got them a shorter sentence. I don't know the exact numbers, but it certainly is something we would want to know. But it is also the case that Colorado has seen a tremendous increase in the number of people who test positive for cannabis who are involved in automobile crashes, particularly ones involving fatalities. Now, I'm not saying that all those people were under the influence at the time. Cannabis can be in your system for quite some time, particularly if you're a regular user. It can be weeks or more before you finally rid yourself of it. But it is just blinking reality to think that a large number of those people who caused those accidents were not under the influence of cannabis.
Is it? But you're at the same time, you're sort of saying we don't really know. That's a very
because
soft
we don't really
statistic.
Know. And there's also a significant difference between presence and impairment, especially with cannabis.
So I think part of what folks have to keep in mind when we're talking about criminal justice reform, legalization presents an opportunity not just to reduce penalties associated with cannabis activity, but these legalization initiatives often are also retroactive, meaning that we're not just changing penalties moving forward, but folks who have past arrests or convictions for marijuana possession, et cetera, they have an opportunity to get a second chance because states are increasingly expunging records, pardoning records. And this is something that President Biden acknowledged in his announcement. One of the things that I find to be ironic is that he acknowledged in this announcement that it was in part because this is activity that states no longer prohibit. Well, I want to share a news flash, one to President Biden, but to everyone on this stage. states are no longer prohibiting activity that ranges across the spectrum. States are affirmatively allowing people to cultivate either for personal use or for commercial activity. There are commercial sales distribution that are happening. And so, Paul, while I can appreciate you acknowledging this simple possession line that gets drawn in the sand, the reality is that there are tens of thousands of people who remain behind bars because maybe the possession that they have was a couple of grams or ounces over whatever that possession threshold is, or they had, if you have bags on you, it can be assumed that you're engaged in sales, or you are actually engaged in sales. And I think we have to be able to get to a point where if we have a multi-billion dollar industry that is making money off of cultivation and sales, then we owe it to the rest of our Americans who are behind bars to say, if you were in jail for cultivation or sales, then maybe you deserve a second opportunity as well.
It really depends on the communities and counties in which they return to, because a lot of the counties in Illinois, once they're released and their records are expunged, they still can't get a job because of their past history, because people can't lie on an application because people will find out. They say second chance, but what does that second chance look like when they're
returning home and they're homeless?
And the other thing is, if you are a marijuana user and you live in public housing,
absolutely,
through the Housing Authority Administration, and someone comes to your house and they smoke weed and it's reported, you become homeless. The bottom line is you can't put your kids out so you can smoke weed. Your children are there. You have to go somewhere else and do it. Educate yourself, educate your families about the pros and your cons, because your health is your wealth, and that's all that
you
have.
We do not disagree with that at all, just like I wouldn't bring my children into a bar. Every time I hear points like the ones you raise, it's not that the underlying thing is something that I cannot understand or see. It just brings me back to, what do you do about it? And the only thing that makes sense to me is to take each of those issues and try to create policy solutions to move that issue off the table, or to at least mitigate the harms. Doing nothing, continuing to criminalize people. I will never forget the first time I saw someone who had been living with the impacts of past criminalized cannabis use tell me that for the first time at this point, who's now approaching 50, that today I'm free because this went away. We expunged or pardoned over 800,000 records in one state alone. 800,000 records. We cannot say that that doesn't have an impact on the community, because really, your neighborhood block, which goes into your neighborhood town and your city and your county, only do better when everyone is allowed to participate fully in the economic stream that we call this country. We can't do that by relegating whole groups of people, especially with the racial impacts that are well documented. The war on drugs failed miserably. It did not stop use. It did not create safety. It did not reduce harm. What it did was criminalize people, and more people who look like us than anybody else. That is unconscionable and immoral.
More from Open to Debate when we return. Welcome back. I'm John Donvan, and this is Open to Debate. Let's jump right back into our discussion. We're going to go to audience questions now, but Paul, I just want to ask you in 30-second response, do you agree that the war on drugs failed miserably?
No.
I mean, wow.
The problem is, you always have to look at the comparison of what would have been the case if you hadn't had a particular activity. You have to look at it at the margin. The fact that it hasn't been completely successful in stopping the use of drugs doesn't mean that it failed. It was never an attempt to completely stop it. It was an attempt to reduce the use.
And it hasn't done that.
And it hasn't done that either.
Okay, I want to go to audience questions now. And to kick us off, I wanted to ask Nick Gillespie. He's editor-at-large at Reason Magazine, and he's a good friend of Open to Debate. He's actually debated with us four times, including a debate in 2012 where we took on the whole question of legalizing drugs. He's even been a guest moderator of some of our debates. Nick, welcome.
Thank you, John. You know, the people who are in favor of legalizing marijuana have been talking a lot about the costs of prohibition. I was wondering if they could talk a little bit, what are the benefits of legalizing marijuana? What's the positive case for it? And I'm also interested if the anti-legalization side will admit or acknowledge any benefits to having legal cannabis or using cannabis.
Thank you. That's a perfectly modeled question. There you go. Kat.
So in terms of the benefits of legalization, I think one of the main benefits is the reduced criminalization, people going to jail, families being separated. That's the main benefit here. But part of the reason why we support legalization and decriminalization is not enough is because decriminalization doesn't address how folks actually access cannabis. And the reality is that people are accessing cannabis, and we believe that people who use cannabis, like other consumers of products, should have products that are tested, that are safe. And when we're regulating cannabis, we have the ability to tax it. There's economic benefit from the revenue going back into communities. Jobs are created. Businesses have an opportunity to flourish. And here in the United States, we're trying to take an equity-centered approach, which is significant, and that we're not just moving forward with legalization and saying that everything goes. We're intentionally trying to acknowledge and address the harms of the war on drugs, and we're making progress in that regard.
So the question to the other side, and it kind of puts you in an awkward position. They're asking you if are any benefits to legalization, which kind of puts you in the position of arguing their side. So we're not going to count it against you.
Well, I can answer that question.
Yeah.
I have family members who came home because of it. So that was a good thing to have my family members back home. But those same family members were unable to get jobs and have to be educated and re-educated and introduced to the community. So we don't have the programs that were set aside to help people to be successful when returning home.
Thank you. If you wouldn't mind telling us at least your first name, we'd appreciate it.
So I'm Jenny from Philly. As just a middle-aged woman with teenage kids, I really appreciated being able to have a conversation with them about drugs where I could say, no, this is just for grown-ups, and that's actually reflected in the legalization. I guess I'd like to hear from the Yes team. I feel like I couldn't have had that kind of conversation if it were just no, 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 no.
I think what you're asking is to the side that's arguing against legalization, whether what was once called the Just Say No policy closes the door to having a real conversation.
Well, I have a daughter and I have a granddaughter who just graduated from high school, so I think I can answer that question. I would say saying no to the drugs is still very important, and looking at the aspect on how it's going to impact them in school. My granddaughter, not only did she smoke weed, but she had tattoos. And guess what? The job that she worked, she had to cover up her tattoos. She had to take a drug test. And if she tested positive, we need to educate our children about how long marijuana actually stays in your system, and it's a minimum of 30 days.
One of the things that I wanted to point out, too, and I thank you for that, Jenny from Philly. I always say I'm Toy from Illinois because it rhymes and it sticks. But what this offers parents is to have real, accurate, and science-based conversations, data-based conversations with their kids. You have access to more information. You have access to more reasons for why you can also tell them why you should not, when you should not, how you should not, how it is significantly more dangerous to do this outside of a regulated market, and open a space for where your children keep talking to you because now they trust that you are a safe person to talk to. If the response is, how dare you? I cannot believe you would do this. If you are kicked out of the house if I find out that you're doing any of these things. What we know is that teens are very good at hiding.
Paul, do you have a response to the question as well, especially in light of what Toy said?
Yeah. I'm not sure why you wouldn't be able to make the same arguments to your kids why they shouldn't do something if it's legal or if it's not legal. I did. I had these conversations with my kids back before 96. And I told them, you may not like the idea that it's illegal, but that's just a reality you have to deal with. You're going to wind up being hurt because of involvement in the criminal justice system. You can wind up being hurt because of involvement in civil society. So if what you're trying to do is talk them out of it, you can make the same argument. If you're trying to talk them into it, then you know, I can't help
it. The fact that it exists across the country and they see it everywhere. This is in every movie, every television. It's on commercials. There are jokes about it. They're all over the place. So parents are competing with all kinds of outside forces, plus social media, plus phones, plus all those things, for the ability to actually train our children in the way we want to go. The fact that it is out in the open and out in the light is one of the most powerful tools you have as a parent to discuss this with your children.
Toy, I'm going to jump in just because in the interest of time, I'd like to see if we can get any more questions.
Thank you. Is there a way right now to test whether a driver is on marijuana or not when, let's say, they get in an accident?
Testing is still evolving in that way. And I say that to say that one of the things that has to be taken into consideration is that presence is not the same as impairment. So you can have marijuana in your system for up to 30 days. You're not impaired by it anymore. If you smoked a joint on the weekend, it's still in your system. There is a free market principle to this too, though, because the fact that government is now making this so that we've got to figure out ways to figure out whether someone's immediately impaired in that moment. So right now, law enforcement is trained to look at all the other things that cause you to be impaired. They're looking at how you're looking, how you're responding to tests. This sobriety test on the roadside thing is very, very important to determine whether or not a driver is actually impaired. And blood testing is coming up, and there are a number of different things that are on there. I think the first company that comes up with a way to tell whether or not you just consumed it is going to be a bozillionaire, and maybe they're in here. I don't know, but it's going to happen.
Maybe somebody in this room will do it.
I want to move on to another question, please. Thanks.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for this conversation. My name is
Sarah. It's a debate.
Debate, yes. We'll certainly acknowledge that.
We insist on that.
I handle criminal justice policy for a group called the R Street Institute, and I have a question to follow up on Toy's opening statement, which is the reality is we have a dual legality issue between a Schedule I substance at the federal level and 38 or more states that have some legal form of cannabis. I'm wondering if both sides can speak to what the practical policy solution is there, whether you oppose legalization. What do you actually do about that dichotomy, and how do you address it?
Let me go to Paul first, because he hasn't had a turn in a bit.
The current situation is quite chaotic, and the only one that can resolve it is Congress. Congress doesn't want to do it. Congress wants to hope that this cup will pass from them. But sadly, they're going to have to, because you can't continue to go on in the status that we have today. But the only way to resolve it is at the federal level, because the states can't tell the federal government what to do, but the federal government can make it a crime regardless of what the states want. So they have to decide whether they want to revise federal law, and they need to do it.
Kat, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I do think that Congress has an opportunity and responsibility to address reform. I think that we need to think holistically about what the respective roles are between the state and federal government. I think that this is an area of law where the states have taken the lead and continue to take the lead. I don't think I've seen anything from the federal government that evidences to me that they are prepared to act in a meaningful way. So I think right now what we need the federal government to be doing is listening to states and learning from their experiences, and hopefully that will move Congress forward on this issue. But I don't think that we're in a place where this particular status is sustainable. I do think that we need reform. I don't think that we're necessarily going to get it through the Biden administration's review of how cannabis is scheduled. But I still expect leadership from the Biden administration and from Congress. And even short of descheduling, there are a whole host of actions that the administration can take to lessen the harms of our current policy today.
We have, I think, time for maybe one more question. And I would love it if you had a question that's addressed to Teresa, because we haven't heard from her in a while.
Oh, sure. So I'm Jeff Lawrence of the Reason Foundation. I'm always curious how conservatives can reconcile general advocacy for limited government with also an advocacy for a government that is so large and intrusive that it can police whether every American has a few grams of marijuana in their pocket.
I don't know the answer to that question. And I would say that it's up to each individual to decide the response.
The question is not whether you have a few grams. The question is whether this is a particular substance that can be harmful if it is allowed to be entered into the stream of commerce like normal products. You know, the federal government doesn't go after people, you know, with just a joint. The federal government goes after people who are
dealing in
large-scale quantity.
Not if you're black or brown. You can have very small amounts. Matter of fact, you don't even have to have the small amount. You just have to smell like it.
That wraps the discussion. Now we go to closing statements. Kat, you are up first. One, to remind everybody you're answering the question is no, legalizing marijuana is not a mistake. One more time to tell us why.
Yeah, so thank you all for your time today. I hope it's made clear that legalization of marijuana isn't a mistake, that it's truly the prohibition that's been a failure. Again, I'm not here to tell you that legalizing marijuana is a panacea or that it's going to solve problems. Legalization doesn't solve problems. Leaders solve problems. And what we need right now is leadership in the form of legalization and regulation. And we have an opportunity to do so the right way. I don't disagree with many of the different complexities and challenges and costs that the folks who said it is a mistake have, but I absolutely disagree with their strategy. We cannot continue to act as if we're going to solve problems by ignoring them. Prohibitionists have always trafficked in misinformation and fear. And I'm here to tell you that you do not have to be fearful. You do not have to be ignorant. We can be educated. We can make progress. But we're not going to be able to do that by continuing to say no.
Teresa, your last chance to make your case for why your answer to the question is yes. You're saying legalizing marijuana is a mistake.
Legalizing marijuana is a mistake. Look around the country. Look around the world. Addictions are everywhere. Why would we want to add one more addiction here in the United States of America? Yes, we are the land of the free, but we also are the land of living, and we are killing one another by legalizing marijuana. Look at our children. Yes, we tell our children that it's not good and they shouldn't be using it. But as soon as you tell them they shouldn't be doing something, they're going to do it. How many of you drank before you were 21? You went to a party, someone gave you a sip of wine, someone gave you a sip of beer, and you thought it was the coolest thing. There is nothing cool about marijuana with young people. I'm talking to a lot of seniors today who have headaches, who have backaches, who have knee pains, who have arthritis, who have other health conditions. They are now using marijuana, closet marijuanas, but they're not sharing that information with their physicians, and they're having counter reactions. Other health problems because of it. The one thing that we're saying is that we need to make sure that we're educating everyone. When you see something, say something. So our goal in Illinois was to plant the seed, say no to weed, especially to children. Educate your children. Let them know if they test positive, if they're involved in sports, if they're going to scholarship, on an academic scholarship, and they're drug testing, they're more likely to lose that scholarship. Now, is it worth it? Their life is worth saving. So say no. Talk to your children. Talk to your community. Thank you.
Thank you, Teresa. Toy, again, you've been arguing all along that legalization is not a mistake. Your last chance to tell us why.
Thank you, everybody, for being here. I've really enjoyed this. I'm one of those people who believes that robust debate is incredibly important, especially for things that are complicated and hard and not easy for any of us to have any simple solutions. Just say no was a simple thing to say to something that was very, very complex. And clearly, it did not work. Right now, when I look across this country and I see, I remember my own grandfather who had lung cancer, and nobody would tell us that doing anything to ease his end of life was something that was bad or horrible or harmful for him, because it worked wonders for him and it gave us more time. I've seen people start businesses. I've seen people really try hard to pull their whole families together to create new economic opportunities for their families when they've been locked up and locked out of something purposefully for decades. And I know about the health benefits. I also know about the fact that when you reduce stigma and people talk about it, what I want is for people to be honest. When you go to the doctor, say what it is you're doing. We live in a drug-infested society. For anybody to believe that cannabis is the thing that's killing our country, no, that would be guns. That would be the criminal industrial complex. That would be hardcore drugs that actually will take you out of here. And to say that cannabis is the same thing as those is doing a disservice to every single person in this country. So we have to tell the truth, we have to use science, we have to use data, and we have to understand the fact that saying nothing, doing nothing, exacerbates a system that doesn't keep any of us safe. It's now time to make a change.
Thank you, Toya. And now to bring it home, we're going to hear one more time from Paul. Paul, just to remind everybody, you're saying legalization is a mistake. Last time for your reasons.
I want to give you three takeaways. And among those takeaways are not going to be just say no. I think if you listen to a transcript, you would see I never used that unduly simplistic approach. I also wouldn't say that children don't know about cannabis. Of course they know about cannabis. They know about alcohol, they know cannabis, all those sorts of things. But I want to say three things, and I'll give you three words for them. Risk, trust, and sacrifice. We are adding to the risk that people feel in society when they start using drugs that they wouldn't use if they were illegal. You should trust the judgment of medical professionals and scientific professionals, unless, of course, they've been polluted by politics. But we can trust the judgment of the Food and Drug Administration because it has never said anything about the political part of this issue. And finally, sacrifice. What we're saying is society should require people to make a sacrifice on behalf of the small number, I'll admit that, maybe 10 to 20 or a little bit more percent, who are going to have very adverse consequences from cannabis use. We're asking people to make that sacrifice because it's for the benefit of our families and our neighbors. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. So, everybody, that concludes the debate. And the last thing I want to say, we owe a special debt of gratitude to a member of our Board of Trustees, Jerry Orstrom, who is an enthusiastic supporter of Freedom Fest, and he made this debate possible. The people I really want to thank right now are our four debaters, Paul and Toy and Teresa and Kat, for the way you conducted this thing for us. You embodied and epitomized the thing that we try to have happen, is to show people that people can in good faith disagree with one another and do so respectfully and civilly. Thank you so much for the way that you all did this. It was spectacular. For all of you listening, I want to thank you for tuning into this episode of Open to Debate. As a nonprofit, our work to combat extreme polarization through civil and respectful debate is generously funded by listeners like you and by the Rosenkranz Foundation and by supporters of Open to Debate. Open to Debate is also made possible by a generous grant from the Laura and Gary Lauder Venture Philanthropy Fund. Robert Rosenkranz is our chairman, Clea Connor is CEO, Leah Mathau is our chief content officer, Julia Melfi is our senior producer, Marlette Sandoval is our editorial producer, Gabriella Mayer is our editorial and research manager, Gabrielle Iannicelli is our social media and digital platforms coordinator, Andrew Lipson is head of production, Max Fulton is our production coordinator, Damon Whittemore is our engineer, Raven Baker is our events and operations manager, Rachel Kemp is our chief of staff. Our theme music is by Alex Clement. And I'm your host, John Donvan. We'll see you next time.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.